You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
My name is Clifford Gaddy from here at the Brookings Institution, and I am very pleased to welcome this standing room only crowd, apparently, to this afternoon's presentation. I want to welcome you here on behalf of two of the programs at Brookings, the Energy Security Initiative and the Center for the United States and Europe. I also especially want to welcome our panelists. We have a very distinguished and I think unusual, in my opinion, quite unusual for this day and time, panelists. Two of the panelists are co-authors together with a couple of other people of the report that you will hear about today. The third panelist is, and I especially want to give a welcome to Robin Dunnigan, Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy Diplomacy at Department of Energy Resources at State Department. So we have a distinguished representative of the government, of our government in the United States, to comment on this report by, well, a European, a Western European, I guess I should say, and a Russian scholar. Tatiana Mitrova is one of the leading specialists on energy economics in Russia and in the world. She is at the Institute for, the Energy Research Institute at the Russian Academy of Sciences and head of the Oil and Gas Department, also is a professor at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow and at the Oil and Gas Research Teaching Universities in Moscow. A very, very prolific scholar and well-known to those in the field. And our own Tim Boersma, Dr. Boersma, is in the Energy Security Initiative, also a very prolific, I must say, an impressively prolific scholar who has written a number of commentaries, ongoing commentaries about the energy security situation, especially in this current critical geopolitical environment, and is working himself on a major book that I guess will be published soon, Tim. So I think, to me, the most striking thing is this report we're going to hear about today is one aspect of what's here, but it's also the participation. Fortunately, it's sad to say, but there aren't many examples still of collaboration between American scholars or an American research institute and Russian scholars. We hope that we're not seeing the last of them for a while. And I think it's very encouraging that you're here, Tatiana, and that you've worked together with us, with Tim, on this report. So it's going to be a unique perspective, and then having Ms. Dunnigan present the U.S. government's position as well as her expert commentary on this report gives us a unique opportunity. So we're looking forward to an hour and a half. We will unfortunately have to cut it short promptly at 3:30, and we're trying to stick tightly to our schedule, which I'll be assisted here by Jen. And let me now turn it over to Tim. Tim, you're going, I think, to introduce the whole idea of the project and the report, and then you'll pass it on, I think, yourself to Tatiana to compliment on, especially the methodology of the work that you've done. And then we're going to let Ms. Dunnigan comment on the report and anything else you would like to say, Robin, in the brief time we'll allow you. Go ahead, Tim.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks, Cliff. Thank you all for being here, of course. I would assume that at some point in time, Europeans are going to be addressed as Europeans, not Western or Eastern Europeans. But as we will touch upon now, Cliff is very accurate in saying that there may actually be a difference, and we're going to get into that a little bit in this report as well, of course. As all of you know, the ongoing turmoil in Ukraine has revitalized once again the debate on European dependence on natural gas from Russia, and I'm sure, as all of you will know as well, is that debate is not really new. It's taken place in 2006 and 2009 when there were significant supply disruptions. I guess contrary to what we've seen today, so far we've not seen a major supply disruption. And in in answer to those disruptions, I guess the answer was sought in supply diversity, finding new sources of supply, new supply routes, and continuing gas market liberalization and integration, so collaboration between member states. The idea being that if you develop your market sufficiently, there would be enough alternative gas in the system, and with enough infrastructure in place, you could ship gas freely throughout the continent, and member states would be resilient to potential supply shocks in the case they would happen. Now, we've witnessed, I think, very substantial progress on this front throughout the larger part of Europe. And we've seen, for instance, very substantial investments in LNG regasification terminals with existing capacity today of almost 200 BCM, which would be around 40% of European annual demand. Now, that's not always being used, but that's another story. It is there. And we've seen significant infrastructure investments in terms of interconnectors, reverse flow options, and storage facilities throughout the larger part of Europe again. Now, in light of... I can hold it here. That's about the best I can do. Is that better? Let's see if this works. Better? Good. So in... I'm not going to repeat what I've just said, if you don't mind. Continue where I was. So in light of Russia's meddling in Ukraine and the unrest that was there, we wanted to test whether the often expressed desire, not just in European capital cities and in Brussels, but also in Washington, D.C., whether that desire to shift away from Russian natural gas would actually take place. Absent what we've called very drastic policy interventions in the existing division of labor between public and private entities, as we know it in a liberalized gas market. Our hypothesis was that this shift away from Russian natural gas would actually not happen. And we thought that would be the case because the main incentive to act for actors in the liberalized market environment is price. And we would not think or expect that, you know, political preference would enter that commercial lexicon. So in addition, the often quoted alternatives, we thought, in particular, importing more LNG, importing more alternative natural gas through the so-called Southern Corridor, or ramping up domestic production of natural gas, in particular unconventional resources, we thought all had substantial limitations. And surely in the short term, but possibly also in the longer term. So we've described this in more detail in our paper. Of course, we acknowledge that the context in which a gas trade takes place today is very different than from what it was about 8 to 10 months ago. We're now in a situation where, you know, essentially the United States and Europe are in what you could call or could label a trade war with Russia, sanctions flying back and forth. And so in that sense, that's a different situation. The other element, I think, that has changed, and it changed long before the Ukraine crisis started, was that pricing of natural gas in Europe has changed as well. And the influence of oversupply, which we saw from about mid-2008 onward in the market, we've seen a lot of pressure on what the traditional pricing mechanism was, oil indexation. And we've seen increasingly, and in particular, again, in the markets that are better developed in Europe, that those pricing mechanisms have come under pressure and have changed to more spot-based pricing. And it's had, in general, not all the time, but in general, had a downward effect on prices of natural gas. And we expect that trend to continue. Now, given this context, I'm sure you'll appreciate that the title of our paper, which is Business as Usual, is somewhat provocative, if you will. Needless to say, we do not imply that nothing has changed or will change in the future of European gas market functioning. The title actually refers to the prominent position that Russian natural gas supplies have and according to our findings, will continue to have in the overall European supply mix. Our analysis, I think, also clearly indicates that this is not necessarily problematic. In fact, following over two decades of market reforms in Europe, it seems to me that for the larger part, European dependence on Russian natural gas is not really problematic and somewhat overstated in most analysis. First of all the majority of member states have enjoyed fairly stable and fairly competitive supplies for several decades, we believe. And more importantly, several member states that are largely dependent on Russian supplies have, because of their policy actions, seen their resilience against supply disruptions and market abuse increase. And I think the cases of Poland and the Czech Republic are very good examples of this. Having said that, I would also say that our analysis shows that a lot of work remains to be done. In particular, in Central and Eastern Europe, this is the case, and that work would refer to implementing existing legislation, further developing a European regulatory framework, and better aligning the national regulatory regimes, and attracting additional investments in gas infrastructure, which of course, in a time when demand is actually decreasing, or staying flat, or maybe even decreasing, is extremely challenging. In Central and Eastern Europe, we see that at the moment still Gazprom continues to be the dominant or even the sole supplier. This situation is not really new. In several of these member states in Central and Eastern Europe, policymakers have been reminded of this ever since 2006, we would argue. And we find it surprising that remarkably little in some of these member states has been done to effectively address this issue. So there's work to be done. So I think in this context, I want to turn it over to Tatjana, who will talk about our methodology and data and our main findings, and I'll get back to you in a bit with some concluding remarks if Tatjana hasn't said it all by then. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, and thanks for the introduction. We have to change
our seats a little bit.
Okay, so what was our methodology and method and data? We were using, don't be scared, it's just the structure of the modeling complex we are utilizing. It's complex which was developed in our Energy Research Institute and which we are normally using for our annual global and Russian outlook, so it's focusing all energy industries, oil, gas, coal, nuclear, renewables. But here in this particular case, we were utilizing just these blocks which are related to the demand projections and global gas model, which we actually, world gas model, which was actually developed initially by a consultancy company Nexant and then integrated into our complex. This is a linear program cost minimization model, very, very detailed, probably one of the most detailed gas models in the world I know. It covers 130 gas producing and consuming countries and models nearly 400 of gas pipeline corridors and nearly 2,000 routes for LNG transportation. It has nearly 800 gas provinces or large gas fields with all their description, with all their cost data and production volumes. And the output which this model delivers based on this cost minimization optimization, it's how much gas will be in demand, how much gas will be produced, supply and demand balances by country, or even for large countries, it is split in the nodes, gas supply costs, rate of utilization of transport capacities, flows by pipeline and by LNG, and of course, most interesting, prices. What is peculiar about this model? It is very well reflecting this hybrid pricing which we have in the gas market. So it has numerous long-term contracts fixed in the model, and they are obligatory for the model. They are taken first, at least take-or-pay volumes, which the buyer has to cover anyway. And it has also spot prices, which are calculated like shadow prices, the price of the marginal supplier. I think it's really quite representative for the task we had, and it has a really unique database standing behind the model. It is a very vast cost database for all the upstream projects, for all gas transportation projects via pipeline, via LNG. It has very good information on infrastructure, all the routes with their tariffs, with their length, gas demand figures, which we were providing based actually on our microeconomic and assumptions and population assumptions. and most importantly, the most confidential, intimate, I would say, part of the gas industry, these are gas contracts. Actually, it's something we've spent a lot of time putting the data together. It's very difficult to find it. You have to make a lot of research in order to get an idea what price formula is there in the contract, what is the volume, what is the duration. So we are using all this data, and here are just a couple of examples. It's just print screen from the model, production potential and costs for supplies or infrastructure, transportation tariffs, dollar per MBTU of supplies. Or here is, for example, contract data, all the long-term contracts Russia has with the OECD European countries. So I suppose it's really quite a huge tool which was applied for several scenarios. What were the scenario assumptions? General assumptions were the same for all five scenarios. We were looking at quite a moderate global gas consumption expectations that it will increase by 1.6% per annum globally, which is not that much, but still good. Gas demand in Europe, according to our estimations, it will begin to recover by 2015 and will grow by 20% by 2040, but all this growth will occur in the last decades of this period. Actually, in the first decade, you see that the pointer doesn't work. You see that demand will not recover to the pre-crisis level of 2008 until the end of the period. So we are actually quite pessimistic about gas demand in Europe. And it will reach 2011 level, which was already after the initial drop. It will reach it only by 2025. So it is quite a skeptical expectations. But if you, for some reasons, assume that Europe will have more optimistic macroeconomic development and regulation for gas demand growth, then it would only increase our arguments concerning the need for Russian gas. But even in this quite weak market, quite low demand, our results are, as Tim said, more like case as usual. We also made very detailed assumptions on country-by-country basis about gas production in Europe, which will drop to nearly 210 billion cubic meters already by 2020, which is minus one-third of production compared to the pre-crisis period. Average CO2 price of 40 euros, which is already a strong assumption. You know, currently CO2 price is about 5 euro per ton. And what is important, we assume that due to the political instability in Iraq and Iran, the southern corridor will be significantly expanding only after 2030. So by the end of the period, you will see this additional volumes 30 to 40 billion cubic meters coming from Caspian, from the Middle East to Europe. But it's also a result of our internal exercise on Iran and Iraq. If you look again on field-by-field basis, it's not an easy story to put all this gas on stream. It's not an easy story to build all the infrastructure. And, of course, until the sanctions are lifted and proper investment climate is created, it's very questionable, especially with ISIS and all these geopolitical stories. And another assumption, which is also important to take into account, is that only planned LNG terminals are built. So no proposed terminals are in this modeling exercise. And actually, in some scenarios, we are showing that, yeah, probably there would be a need for additional LNG terminals construction in Eastern Europe, first of all, Central and Eastern Europe, because it might become a constraint. So Just to illustrate, I've shown to you European gas demand. Here is the picture of total gas production on country-by-country basis, and you see the drop in this decade is already quite significant. Then it is more or less flattering. With some shale gas production assumed, we are, frankly speaking, quite skeptical about it, but just to be, you know, to have a balanced approach, we used here more or less optimistic expectations about production of shale gas in Poland and in the UK. So 20 BCM, some experts would argue that it's already too much, but we decided, okay, it's a fair game. Let's take as much shale gas as possible. And so here are the scenarios which we were regarding. So the baseline scenario, case as usual, Brent price $100 per barrel, which we used already to during the last 4 years. Russian contracts are extended by 10 years after their expiration. They will start to expire post-2022. And then we assume that they will be extended, but with a different price formula. With the increasing share of spot indexation, we assumed it to be like 35%. We could argue about it, but that was like a basic assumption, which seems to be reasonable and acceptable for the Russian side. South Stream is constructed in this scenario, and Ukrainian transit is accessible, so everything is fine. Second scenario is assuming that there is no contract extension, so when they finish, that's it, and no new, then Russia has either to sign new contracts or European consumers will choose other suppliers. High oil prices is $120 per barrel, well, could be. No South Stream construction scenario if European Commission doesn't allow Russia to build it. Or if, for the geopolitical reasons, no Ukrainian transit is accessible. So that is the playing field. And so what did we get in terms of scenario results? Here is the baseline scenario. Anyway, even in the case as usual, LNG supplies to Europe will increase. It's the first finding. And you see that utilization rate of LNG terminals, which is the red line on this left graph, which is currently just 30%, it's very low. It will increase up to more than 50%, while utilization of the pipeline capacities will decline. And the reason for that development is this LNG glut. All this new LNG, which is expected globally, not in Europe, globally, Australia, East Africa, North American LNG, which will, according to our modeling, mainly target Asia, but it will affect the whole global situation, and it will bring European gas prices and the hubs down. So you see, already starting in 2017, European prices are going down, except for the Central European gas hub, which is located obviously in Central Europe and which doesn't have access to this LNG due to its geographical location. So here the prices remain higher. And then when this glut will be more or less absorbed by the consumers globally, the prices start to increase. And this development in this situation, the structure of the European gas balance actually doesn't change considerably. So you see this, the share of Russian gas supplies, which is blue part, it is becoming diminishing somehow post-2030 and then expanding again. LNG imports are definitely increasing, and it looks like Russia is providing the base load, and LNG is covering this increasing gap between indigenous production and demand. So LNG is compensating for the falling indigenous production. That's the structure of the market. And here in the baseline scenario, in terms of competing suppliers. The share of Caspian and Middle Eastern countries will nearly triple by the end of the period when all these Iraqi gas will become available, as I mentioned, post-2030 most likely, while LNG imports will also become more diversified, you see. But at the same time, pipeline gas imports from Russia, they will remain at the level of 150-160 billion cubic meters until 2025, including re-export of gas from Central Asia. And then, as the contracts will expire, they will drop down to 125-135 billion cubic meters, which is still a lot. So there is some decline in the Russian gas, in the pipeline, in the share of Russian pipeline gas in the European market. You can see currently it's about 30%, and then it will go down to 25%. But at the same time, some of Russian LNG will come to the European market. Which means that in total, Russian presence will still be quite considerable, though the overall gas mix will become definitely more diversified. In the scenario when contracts are not extended, then LNG imports are increasing faster, obviously, but actually it doesn't drive any spot price decline. So there is such a myth that cheaper LNG could replace expensive Russian gas. But if you make an optimization and if you take into account production and shipping costs for this LNG, it's not that much cheaper than Russian gas. And so in this scenario, gas exports from Russia fall to just 100 billion cubic meters by 2040. Russia is supplying additional 32 BCM as LNG. But generally, even in this case, prices in the market, they change by only 6%, which means that Russian gas is quite competitive and LNG is not cheap at all. And if we are talking about high oil price scenario, it is compared to the baseline scenario, gas prices are like 6 to 7% higher, which also doesn't make any significant difference for the European consumer compared to all the other changes in the market. And in scenario without South Stream, actually, there are no significant differences or difficulties at all. Simply look at this graph showing Russian transportation capacities via Europe, and you can see without South Stream, Russia can manage easily through Ukraine, Belarus, Yamal, Europe, Blue Stream, and Nord Stream. So there are already enough sufficient gas transportation capacities, just increasing partially transit through Ukraine, Moldova, and Blue Stream, Russia can completely replace the volumes of South Stream. And I would say that in all scenarios, South Stream is not utilized at 63 BCM capacities. It's utilized at 25, 30 BCM, which is actually posing the question how large it has to be. Scenario without Ukrainian transit, probably the most interesting one. Actually, completely shutting transit through Ukraine will reduce gas consumption in Europe by 6% in 2015 and 1% in 2040. So it doesn't have this catastrophic impact. In this situation, actually, Russian pipeline gas in 2015, it is the major difference. It is less by 47 BCM. It's a huge drop. For the gas which cannot be transported via Ukraine. But then, actually, with the South Stream construction and with the complete utilization of all the other routes, the situation is becoming nearly the same. And spot prices are remaining unchanged, nearly unchanged in this scenario, which is most important, except again for the Austrian hub, which doesn't have other alternatives. So these are our main findings, and I think Tim will sum up the conclusions of that.
Thanks. Thank you, Tatiana, for the overview. I'll keep it very brief because I think that most important lessons have been touched upon in the analysis that you just heard. I think our main conclusion would be, and to get back to the hypothesis that we wanted to test when we started doing this project, is that we do not expect major changes in the European gas supply mix, as has been pled for by many politicians, of course, particularly in Europe, but also on this side of the Atlantic. The only, what I think, very substantial change that we see in the longer run is that the share of LNG in the European supply mix is going to increase, which may sound to some as some kind of relief, but we would stress that that these supplies mostly replace domestic production in Europe, which, as I'm sure many of you know, is declining fairly substantially, in particular in the Netherlands, which is currently the largest producer of natural gas. So from an energy security standpoint, I think that in the short and medium term, the lack of market integration in Central and Eastern Europe and collaboration between different member states in that part of the continent continues to be problematic. And as Tatiana has outlined, in our scenario in which Ukraine no longer functions as a transit state for natural gas, we actually see no significant or no meaningful impacts of that, which is quite substantial if you take into account that about 40% of Russian gas that goes through Ukraine. Again, if that's supply route is cut, we don't see meaningful impacts on 7 of the 8 hubs that we've studied. The only one where we do see it is Austria, which is sort of an indicator of the lack of market integration in Central and Eastern Europe. And in my view, it confirms that European market integration generates very meaningful results. We would have seen different outcomes had we done this same analysis, I think even if we go back only 5 years ago. And so in the unfortunate case of a supply disruption in Central and Eastern Europe, that would still be a problem. And it reiterates that quite a bit of work needs to be done still to make that part of the continent more resilient to possible supply shocks. As Tatiana said, we believe that Russian natural gas is going to be very competitive in Europe. And although Russian companies are expected to lose some market share in terms of pipeline gas, a part of that is probably replaced with LNG, assuming that at some point in time the sanctions will be lifted, which of course we don't know, because if they would stay in place for a very long time, that would have repercussions, of course, for ongoing LNG projects in Russia. Third, in our analysis, we account for increases of supply from all the often mentioned alternatives, but as Tatiana outlined, we don't think that any of them are going to be very transformative in terms of the overall European natural gas mix. So you've heard that we do account for increases through the Southern Corridor, which in some point in time surely will happen, but not in the very short term, and not even in the medium term, one could argue. And we think that the other alternatives, such as ramping up shale gas production, all have their own difficulties, as touched upon earlier. So in sum, I think our analysis suggests that the transformation of the fuel mix in Europe is not going to take place. And we believe that all these alternatives that we've touched upon are very important in their own right, and we don't want to downplay them. I want to make that point specifically. But we do think that we should keep them in perspective. So we believe that the share of Russia in Europe's natural gas mix is going to be substantial. And we also find in our analysis that for the larger part of Europe, that's not problematic. So we believe, to sum this up, that the ways forward in terms of European energy security lie in more European collaboration and market integration, in particular in the small part of the continent where this has not already happened. I think I should leave it.
Thank you very much, Tim and Tatiana. So now I'm going to turn it over to Robin Dunnigan for comments on the report, and as I said, any other comments you would choose to make. The floor is yours.
Well, first, thank you for inviting me, and I thought the report was excellent. I don't know if most of you have had the chance to read it. I thought it was very good. And I think the primary conclusion, the main takeaway that I had from it, was that Russian energy is going to continue to be an important part of the mix in Europe, and that's something that the U.S. government agrees with, and we've been saying that, you know, in all of our discussions over the last 4 or 5 months, we've been very careful to say that in broader Europe, but also in Ukraine, that Russian oil and gas is going to be an important part of the mix. And I think your report, you know, kind of scientifically gets to that point. But that doesn't mean, in our view, that we don't need to keep working, and Europe doesn't need to keep working on energy diversification, which we think is absolutely critical to energy security. So I'll talk a little bit about our engagement with Europe on that, because our bureau and my office, we're not the technical experts. We really do focus on the energy diplomacy part of it, which is how do we engage with Europe in a way that supports Europe's energy security and the United States' energy security. The report also underscores how important commercial realities are in the European energy mix. And again, that's something that we absolutely agree with, that often decisions are made based on what's commercially viable and what's not. And I think your report underscores that. This points to a question that we are always asked, so I will just raise it, is the role of U.S. LNG exports in Europe's energy security picture. And we're asked a lot about that because of the licensing process, and Europe's not an FTA country, European countries aren't FTA countries. And what about TTIP, and what will that do for European energy supplies? And I think a couple of points are noteworthy. One is that, as your report alludes to, we don't think U.S. LNG exports is a panacea or a golden pill that's going to fix the European energy security problem, or energy security challenges, I should say, not problem. But in fact, our gas, what's happened, you know, kind of the gas revolution in the United States has impacted Europe, because we're not importing the quantities that we are importing more. So there's more LNG on global markets, and that's affected pricing. It's affected, you know, regional hubs. It's affected the ability for buyers to sell, buyers and traders to move quantities more quickly. And as Tatiana mentioned, it's not just the United States. There's a lot of new gas coming online, you know, Eastern Med, Australia, East Africa. You know, the picture could look very different in 3 to 5 years, and I wouldn't want to, you know, I think it would be a, if I were a betting woman, I wouldn't bet on what it's going to look like, because we don't really know what it's going to look like in 5 years. But I think it's fair to say that the fact that we are importing less and there's more global, you know, more LNG on the market has affected Europe's ability to negotiate with Russia as a sole supplier. It also has to do with regulatory practices and spot pricing in Europe, but it's also given a lot of European utilities more leverage with the, you know, with Gazprom. So I want to talk a little bit about our relationship with the European Union in particular on some of these energy security issues more broadly. And most of my comments really are in line with your report. I think that there are a lot of conferences and a lot of questions about European energy security in the last 5 or 6 months, but I think it's fair to say that U.S. State Department's been working on these issues for nearly 20 years, starting with BTC. One of my very early jobs in the State Department was energy officer in Turkey 15 years ago, and one of my main priorities was the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline, which we didn't have a commercial U.S. commercial interest in. So I think we've long recognized the need to move new gas and oil supplies from new sources into Europe. And the Southern Corridor, Southern Gas Corridor, is on the verge of becoming a reality, and again, U.S. diplomatic engagement has been, I think, very important in making that, you know, actually, it looks like it's going to happen and will happen soon. Kind of the flagship of U.S.-EU energy cooperation is the U.S.-EU Energy Council. That's met 5 times since 2009. On our side, Secretary Kerry and Secretary Moniz chair it with their counterparts from the EU. We last met in April 2nd in Brussels, where we agreed on kind of a diplomatic engagement plan for Ukraine's energy security this winter and looking forward on how we work together on other European energy security issues. We've worked with Central and Southeast European countries on the interconnectors, reverse flow, prioritizing some of the infrastructure projects so that those can get the funding, the European Union funding that's available. We've worked a lot with our European partners on contingency plans for this winter. If in fact there is a need for contingency planning. We've worked with our European partners on trying to ensure that where there's possible infrastructure projects that need private investment, that U.S. companies are aware of those projects and have a chance to bid on those projects, so attracting private investment to some of those infrastructure projects. So in the end, I think your report concludes that the challenges that are out there are really the EU's challenges to resolve, but I think that the U.S. and EU have worked together in a really productive way, not just in the last year, I mean over, you know, many years. I would say that I think Europe's better off today than it was in 2009. Storage is more full. The third energy package was a very important development. Some of the very important infrastructure projects have happened. And I can talk a lot about what we're doing with Ukraine together with the European Union, but maybe that's better in a Q&A, and I can stop my remarks there.
Thank you very much. I'm going to turn it over to questions from the audience in a minute, but I wanted to get a couple of questions off my own mind here. Chairman Tatiana, your report, the theme of your report, the conclusion is business as usual. One could argue that you've set up the whole thing with your assumptions to come out with a conclusion of business as usual. And I'm thinking of a couple of points in particular. You've said that, especially Tatiana, in the assumptions you made, you steer away from radical assumptions. You want to keep things err on the side of caution. The problem with that, some people might say, is you are tending then to eliminate in advance some of the more interesting scenarios, which, true, may be low probability scenarios, but consequences would be very great. So when we talk about the idea of contingency plans, you know, this is what you might want to hear from you. And I realize you have limited scope for running these scenarios, but two things in particular rise in my mind. The two things, at least, that I, as a non-expert, think about in terms of the global energy situation today are the oil price, which is not $100 a barrel and certainly not $120 a barrel. It's going lower. It's lower now, and it might well stay lower. I don't know. What do you say about that? So why did you not consider $80 or $60? Give us something interesting in there. And the other is the sanctions, or the whole geopolitical situation in general, I might say. You've said you expect sanctions to be eventually lifted. I'm sure eventually they will be lifted. But what if sanctions were to actually remain in place or be even more severe enough to fundamentally impact, say, Russia's production and possibly provoke counter-sanctions by the Russians? Same thing I might say about the Ukraine scenario, by the way. Now, you do have the scenario that Ukrainian transit is cut off. And I don't know, was I supposed to feel comforted by the fact that by, 20 years from now, we'll be back at the kind of level we are now, when I saw that huge dip of 30%, that it wasn't just overnight that it was going to be. It was going to be there for several years. It was a long period of European gas consumption that was much, much lower than what it is today. Maybe I read the chart wrong, but it doesn't seem like to me that's something you can just the consequences of that for the European economies, it seems to me, would be quite severe. And what other spin-off effects or what other effects might happen. So my basic question is this, and there's a basic question about your assumptions for the scenarios. Why did you not really think of throwing out there a couple of more radical assumptions? But specifically, I think I would like to ask about the oil price. And so that's addressed to the two of you.
With the oil price, actually, as I said, we try to make it an absolutely fair and objective assessment. From the modeling side, I can say we did not intervene model in any way. You know, you can adjust here and there and get the result you want. Here it was absolutely clear exercise. And with oil price, actually, if oil prices are going down, Russian gas is becoming more and more competitive. I mean, it's oil linked. And with $80 per barrel price, it will be already more competitive than any LNG globally. than any spot-based supply. So that means that it didn't make sense to go for scenarios which are more favorable for Russian gas to remain. So it is something we understand. We could take higher European gas demand. As I said, we took very, very low figures. Then call for Russian gas would be higher. Concerning Ukrainian transit, I think you really read the graph incorrectly because it was showing only pipeline flows to Europe. Mm-hmm. So it's the same European gas consumption. Oh. It is simply covered partially by more LNG supplies. So for these first years of this Ukrainian crisis, Russian supplies go down. And they are covered by LNG supplies. Then Russian supplies are restoring, and that's why we are saying that nothing dramatic is happening. First of all, thanks to Nord Stream, 55 BCM capacity, Yamal Europe, 30 BCM capacity, Blue Stream, 16 BCM capacity, and Finland Route. So altogether, it means that actually we are talking about 30 to 40 BCM, which could go through Ukraine or could be delivered from LNG. Attracting 30 BCM from LNG for a little bit higher price, it's not such a disaster for Europe. So here I think I cannot actually imagine any additional significant black swans which could change the whole story. We were discussing it internally. Okay, maybe energy efficiency, maybe if Europe will, I don't know, push on energy saving and switch more to coal. No, stop. Tim told me no coal. Energy efficiency, again, it's something which is Europe is making on temporary basis, but it is a very slow process. You cannot expect like overnight revolution which changes the whole picture. So what else? I do not know. What could be this game changer, actually? You can add.
I'm happy to add. I would agree with all of that. We actually debated an $80 oil price scenario, I recall, when we were starting this study and looking at all the studies that, you know, look out in the longer run, 2030, 2040. We thought, if given indeed that we had limited room to do all these scenarios, that the one that was the least likely was the $80 oil price scenario, particularly in the longer run. I wish in light of what we know today, we would have done it. It would have been good to look at that scenario in light of oil prices being, as you just told me, $86 and a little bit. So it would have been interesting, but as Sajana said, it wouldn't have made a huge impact on Russian natural gas supplies in Europe. In fact, the share would be larger than it is in our other scenarios. I would say that the two scenarios that we looked at, one without South Stream being built, the other one without Ukrainian transit, surely one could think of scenarios that are even more disruptive, but I would call them fairly disruptive. Mm-hmm. The South Stream pipeline is being built, and so there's a lot of upheaval, and this process has been stalled now. But actually blocking the construction of that pipeline, I think, would be what I see at least as a very substantial and significant decision in Europe. Now, I'm not saying it could not be made. It could be made. But then, interestingly, indeed, we find that it doesn't really have any meaningful effect. The same goes for Ukrainian transit. And I think you're right, even though the time frame may be shorter, as we highlight in our study. I mean, the effects on Central and Eastern European markets and on the Austrian hub, to me, are and I hope to others, are a good reminder that, you know, Europe has a lot of work to do there. The frustrating part of it, at least for me, is that this is not news. I mean, we've known this for roughly a decade now that you know, more collaboration in that part of the continent is really needed in order to increase resilience to supply shocks. And our analysis shows that that's currently not the case. Now, we can blame Russia for that, of course, if we wanted to. But quite frankly, I think we should blame our own policymakers for not addressing those issues, right, in countries like Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, because there's just a lot of work to be done. Existing legislation that should have been implemented years ago that's not been done and such. So a lot of work there to be done. On the sanctions front, of course, it may be tempting to say, look, let's assume that sanctions stay in place for a decade or so. I don't know how likely that is. I would think not very likely, but who am I? I don't know. I think if that were to be the case, it would have meaningful impact, of course. But the sanctions today are designed in a way, and I think this is important to keep in mind, that they do not affect any of the current production or deliveries or shipments to Europe or to the global markets for that matter. I mean, they've been designed to specifically target longer-term technologically challenging projects because that's where the U.S. and Europe and Western IOCs, I guess, have some leverage left, and we can debate how large that leverage really is. But so the shale oil reserves in Russia, which are allegedly the largest in the world, and Arctic resources, which are allegedly very large as well, they were not expected to come on stream before, 2030 and beyond 35. We could assume that sanctions stay in place until then, but it sounds like a bit of a stretch to me. I hope it's a bit of a stretch, actually.
Very good. Very wise answers, and I'm glad I showed my ignorance by asking them, so maybe other people will benefit from that as well. Let me turn it over now to those of you in the audience. This huge crowd here, I'm sure, has a lot of important questions to ask. I would only ask that we have assistance with the microphones. The microphone will come to you, so don't start talking until you are recognized, and the microphone is in your hand. And if you would do, as the first thing, if you would just identify yourselves, please, and keep your questions or comments fairly pithy. I want to start here with Charlie Ebinger, who is the director of the Energy Security Initiative. Charlie?
Thank you, Cliff. I may have read your chart wrong, but I was surprised to see a fairly flat line of gas from Algeria. Now, granted, we know Algeria has terrible political problems at the moment, but if we're looking out to 2040 with unconventional gas reserves, some people believe in excess of what the U.S. has and a lot of still undeveloped conventional gas, I was wondering why you're so sober about that. And a quick second question is, what makes you believe if Iran and Iraqi gas actually ever can enter the market with some kinds of political settlements, it won't go to Asia rather than to Europe?
So concerning Algeria, and actually we are making this exercise with Algeria and Norway all the time, trying to find whether they are able to deliver more gas to the European market because they are currently the major suppliers together with Russia. Both of them, it seems they can't. Norway just reached its plateau production, and the question is how long they will be able to remain at this plateau, and all the new discoveries, they are just prolonging this period but not increasing the volumes. With Algeria, the problem is that the production is declining already, not even stagnating as it used to be like 4 or 5 years ago. Now it is declining every year, and Algeria struggles to survive to deliver its contracted volumes already. Yes, they have additional, mainly unconventional reserves, so they have some conventional, but these are much more complicated, demanding new technologies as well, demanding huge investments. The whole institutional framework completely doesn't match this development, and delivery costs of this gas, I mean production together with transportation, makes it not very competitive in Europe. So until 2025, 2030, we cannot expect any additional gas, even if tomorrow they will start to invest. These are quite long-term projects. But even then, when this gas will be hopefully produced and delivered, it is not the cheapest one as it used to be with the traditional Algerian gas. So it's a different resource base. It's a different development.
Very good. Yes, please. On the sixth or seventh row back there.
Hi, Brenda Schaefer, Georgetown University. One question and one comment. One on the methodology, Europe as a unit. I mean, that's like saying if you could say that it would affect 6% of the disruption of transit through Ukraine would affect 6% of the gas to Europe. Sure, that could be 0.5% to France, but it could be 100% to Bulgaria. So how in your methodology do you find room for that diversity, which is so different in how those disruptions impact different European markets? And second, on the comment, I would like to actually to join Dr. Gotti's comment about radical events, because the radical events actually are the only thing we can say are pretty normal. Every 5, at most 10 years, we have a radical event in the world system that dramatically affects supply and demand. We can, you know, easily say the fall of the Soviet Union, September 11th, the financial crisis. We could see the next thing, Ebola. You know, would be a radical change. So, how do we factor in radical events, because they are the normal?
Well, it's a problem, billion-dollar question for any forecasting think tank, how to forecast unpredictable events. I'm afraid I do not have an answer for that. Usually these are brainstormings and how do they call it? Oracle, Delphi questionnaires. It's very difficult to model them, because usually all the factors that you've mentioned, they are lying behind model assumptions. So I don't know.
I'm contemplating what the effects of the Ebola crisis on gas demand in Europe would be. On a more serious note, I think Tatjana said it excellently. There are certain things that you cannot model and that you cannot foresee happening. Right? That doesn't mean they don't happen. Of course, they do. And then the question is, what is their impact? That's a valid point, but it's not something that you can take into an analysis like this, because you cannot forecast.
How about the point about distinguishing?
Yeah,
parts of Europe,
country by country. It's my fault. I was trying to put all our findings in like 6 slides. It's a challenge. It's much more in detail described in the paper, and of course, it's on country. It's calculated on country by country basis. Definitely not Northwestern Europe simply doesn't feel any change at all. It's all about Central and Eastern European countries. And there it's also different. I would say Bulgaria and Hungary seem to be most affected by these disruptions. And here, as Tim correctly mentioned, I mean, Bulgaria has felt it already in 2009, and it was obvious that they need underground storages and reverse flows and additional interconnectors. It was absolutely obvious, but it was not done. And I'm afraid that now I am following the situation. I do not see any preparation for cold winter at the moment, which I think, I mean, you're not, I hope we will avoid any crisis this winter, but not taking any measures if you know there is a threat, it's not responsible way. So there are figures in the paper, and I think the paper is already available on your website, so you can download it with all the graphs and all the figures.
That's an important point.
So I forgot to mention it. Yes,
say that
it's
again.
An important point. Yeah. It's at brookings.edu/ESI, I would presume. We could, yeah, good. So there you can find the paper and more background on these issues.
Robin, any comments here?
I think that the question really points to why our policy has been, the U.S. government's policy has been, countries should have an all-of-the-above strategy, and they should really look to diversification of sources and supply. Because there are unknown events that can impact, you know, where you're getting your gas and how you're getting it. And so I think diversity is really key. And your question just underscores that.
Great. Here, at the second, third row.
Rob Warren, you did not cover this in your study in a great detail, but I was wondering, could you analyze the situation in Ukraine regarding natural gas supplies at this time? There seems to be an indication that the price is going to be increased. They may have difficulty getting the quantity. What might be the impact? A cold winter?
Not an easy one. At the moment, Ukraine has about 16.5 billion cubic meters of gas in the underground storages. It is producing approximately 20 billion cubic meters domestically. It might have.
Microphone, please. Is it better? Yeah, I can hear. Ukraine is now, it has arranged some reverse flows from Eastern European countries. So altogether, it gives more or less additional supplies, more or less sufficient supplies to go through warm winter. But even for an average winter, I would say, according to our calculations, Ukraine would need additional 5 to 7 billion cubic meters of gas, which it can currently get only from Russia, because there are no other sources available. And you know that on Thursday, Putin and Poroshenko are meeting, they have this discussion. Hopefully, there will be a temporary contract for just 6 months to go through the winter time. On a temporary price basis. So it's like a very short-term solution, but I hope that it will be done, because otherwise it means that either industrial consumers will be cut off when gas is over if there is a cold winter. Last winter was warm. Yeah. Or residential consumers will suffer. And don't forget that due to all these events, it's not just gas lacking in the Ukrainian fuel mix, but also coal, because most of coal, which was traditionally produced in Donetsk and Lugansk, out of 90 mines, just 25 are functioning at the moment. The others are bombed or fired, or they are destroyed. And the railroad is destroyed. So coal supplies, they are also under disruption, and Ukraine will have to import additional coal from Western Europe, from Russia, from everywhere around the world. I think they've even signed a contract with South Africa. So it's not just a potential gas crisis, but it could be an overall energy crisis. And I hope that timely decisions will be made right now to fix somehow this situation.
Thank you, Tatiana.
Yeah, because we've been working really closely with Ukrainians and with the Europeans on exactly this question: what happens to Ukraine this winter, and in the medium and long term too, not just the immediate term. And we've also played with the variables, you know, the mild winter, economic growth or lack thereof, what happens with the reverse flows. The good news is the reverse flows from Slovakia and Poland right now are pretty much close to 100% capacity, between 95 and 100% capacity, which is a little more than a BCM a month, which is great. And Ukraine has filled its storage up to 16.5 BCM. But I would agree that no matter how you play it, it looks like Ukraine is going to need some more gas this winter. And so we've been coordinating very closely with the EU and working with the Ukrainians in hopes that the most recent EU proposal is something that both the Russians and the Ukrainians can live with and come to an agreement on. We hope in the next couple of weeks they do reach an agreement, some sort of interim agreement. On the medium and long term, I think it's important that, you know, we're not having the same discussion next October. So we have put into place the U.S. government through the Department of Energy, USAID, and the State Department. We're looking at working with Ukraine, and a lot of other governments are doing similar type programs. So this, we're not the only ones doing it, but looking at how does Ukraine increase its domestic production? You know, it's been at about 20 BCM for, I think, 20 years. And so how do you rehabilitate existing fields to increase domestic production, energy efficiency measures, you know, sort of a whole host of things that hopefully, you know, by next winter or in 5 years from now, Ukraine can choose to buy Russian gas and won't have to.
Great, thank you. More questions? Here, let me take on the fourth row.
Thank you. My name is Igor Dunaevsky. I'm a reporter for a Russian newspaper. My question is for Mrs. Dunnigan. Could you take a bit deeper into, is the shale gas is part of U.S. You know, like assistance and consultations with Ukrainian government. I mean, do you consider that exploring shale gas in Ukraine can contribute to its energy independence? And could you tell maybe a bit about perspective of U.S. Companies' investments in gas in Ukrainian energy sector, basically? Thank you.
I think I'd say the same thing for Ukraine that we'd say for all of Europe, that every country makes its own decisions about which resources it's going to develop and how it's going to develop them. We do have a program, the unconventional UGTEP, unconventional gas technical, I don't know what it all stands for. Which if a country is going to explore unconventional gas resources, that we work with countries on best practices and lessons learned from the experience in the United States. But the commercial decision to go forward with that exploration is up to the country and up to the private sector. What we are doing with Ukraine is working a little bit on the regulatory structures. We're giving some assistance for regulatory reforms so that if and when they choose to do that, they can attract good private investment, the private sector, to explore the potential.
Thank you. Yes, sir. One second. We're right behind you.
Thanks. Barry Wood, RTHK in Hong Kong. I wonder if you could talk a bit about South Stream. I didn't get the figure that you projected for its capacity, but more significantly, is it going to be built? It's certainly not being built in Europe now, in Western Europe. And I wanted to ask Robin, in terms of the United States policy of opposing South Stream, how do you answer the Bulgarians and Hungarians and others who want that gas?
First, maybe just on the facts of the stage of construction.
In the model we had the whole capacity, 63 BCM. But in all our runs, it was not utilized completely due to the weak European demand. So its utilization rate was varying from 5 to 11 BCM up to 30 BCM per annum. So which is like two strings. If we assume higher European gas demand, it could of course go far beyond these figures. But in these runs, it was not that strong.
I was interested in your slide, and tell me if I read it wrong, but in there's no South Stream option, the gas made its way other ways and got there.
Yeah.
And that's really what we've said on South Stream. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to us. The same gas, a different route for a lot of money. So rather than say we oppose it, it just doesn't seem to make, I don't see it. And your research seemed to play that out. But more importantly, the EU right now has asked its member states to wait, take a look, make sure that the project is in line with European rules under the Third Energy Package. And, you know, I think that we need to let the member states and the EU, we need to let that process play out and see where we are when everyone has done their reviews of their agreements and looked at it in the context of the Third Energy Package.
Back there, the furthest one back, you see?
Brian Beery, Washington correspondent, Europolitics. I was wondering, could you give examples of countries in Europe that have already taken measures to minimize the disruption, both in the short-term and long-term measures, sort of the more positive stories on what countries have done.
I think that the most prominent examples are Poland and the Czech Republic, I would think. I mean, both countries have, with the help of European funds, invested fairly significantly, in the case of Poland, very significantly in infrastructure. Reverse flow options on existing pipelines, for instance, and interconnectors with Germany and the Czech Republic, and I think another one with Lithuania is being planned at the moment. And what it's done, it's essentially allowed the Polish to be more resilient in case supplies from Russia would not come to Poland. It could attract alternative gas from either the Netherlands or Norway or natural gas from in the form of LNG from northwestern Europe. So you see that it's worked in the Czech Republic, less substantial in terms of financial means. Measures have been taken, so cheaper options because the country has a smaller market. But as a good sign that it's worked, in July of this year, the Czechs have stopped their virtual trading point because they realized they were essentially part of the German market. So whatever it, you know, would happen in Czech Republic, it could be countered by natural gas from Germany. I think those are the most prominent examples where you see that this actually works, and that European collaboration here works. And so there's more work to be done in some of these other member states, but there has been a lot of progress, as Undersecretary Dunnigan said. Europe is a lot better off. It's a lot better off now than it was in 2009.
Could I just add on a thought onto this, or a question onto this general question? Maybe Tim, maybe Tatiana, I don't know, but Tim, I know you think in these terms all the time. If you think about the kinds of everything you've described about the measures taken by the Europeans, if we reflect on all the arguments that were given for all the different energy packages and energy reforms, part of it is about increasing competitiveness. Presumably, it's market. It's improving the market, which the goal of which ultimately is lower cost, more efficiency and lower cost. The other reason that's always in everybody's minds about all these reforms in Europe, from infrastructure and everything else, is, of course, about energy independence, about, well, very specific, let's be direct about it, reducing dependence on Russia. And like almost any policy of insuring yourself or providing more security in any respect, it's costly. You are choosing not to do the most efficient thing, even though if the world were perfect and the Russians were the nicest guys in the world, you'd take the Russian gas and you wouldn't ask questions because it makes most sense. You say they shouldn't do that because then you're exposing yourselves to the leverage of bad Russians. In general, I know this is an impossible question to ask with any great degree of rigor perhaps, but just in general, if you look at everything that's been done and everything you're now talking about that Europe should be doing, how big of a trade-off is there between economics, which certainly should be pretty prominent on everybody's mind if you're European and thinking about the fragility of the European economy and recovery. So between economics on the one hand and security on the other, what would you say about that?
I think it's an excellent question. The way I see look at what's happened in Europe over the last say decade or two is I would argue that economics prevail in almost all of these situations, and I think I would point at the lack of investment that we've seen in parts of Central and Eastern Europe until very recently, also in countries like Poland. So on the one hand, you have a security narrative which you hear very prominently in Eastern Europe, and I guess this is where Eastern and Western Europeans are somewhat different. That security narrative which tells you Russians are bad news and you don't want to be dependent on them, and this is a problem. But on the other hand, you can observe that the actions taken do not really match that big security threat, because if this was such a big problem, as is often portrayed in policy debates in that part of the continent, then you should wonder why on earth hasn't this been addressed a long time ago, right? So in the case of Poland, where I've done quite a bit of work a number of years ago, we hear this all the time. You talk to any policymaker, and the first thing that happens is you get a lot of big security talk and a lot of rhetorics about Russia and how this is problematic. Talk to business people in Poland, you'll get a very different narrative, because these people will go for the cheapest option. They'll go for the economics. And so they'll trade with Russia and say, well, you know, by and large, we've enjoyed fairly stable and fairly competitive surprise. Politicians see this differently. But then if you look at what actions have been taken to address this problem, they don't correspond. Those two narratives don't correspond. So I think this is part of the problem in the European context, and it has hindered some of these countries to address their energy security challenges, if you will, if you still want to call them security challenges, of course.
I also add to that, you know, I just was thinking, what was the most successful measure that Europe has undertaken during the last 10 years in order to reduce dependence on Russian gas? Economic crisis. Dropped demand. That was really the main driver why Russian exports to Europe are now not 180 as they were supposed to be according to the contract signed by Europeans, but just 135. That's how the dependence was reduced. I don't think that it's really productive way to reduce the dependence. And actually, all our modeling exercises showing that the price of the question we are discussing, the volume, it is like 30 billion cubic meters, whether they will be coming from Russia or from the other sources. It's a big deal, yeah, but not such a big deal. So definitely, if I were in European shoes, I would go for diversification. But at the same time, it's very important to have this perspective, where is elephant in the room and where you are just putting some cherries on the cake. So it is important to have cherries as well. But first of all, I would try to manage the cake to be properly prepared.
I guess, in fairness to our European colleagues and partners, I do think we should go back to the fact that there has been really important progress made in many countries over the last decade. And the third energy package has had and will continue to have really important effects on making the market more integrated and more competitive. I think it's also important to note in this conversation that as dependent as Russia, as Europe is, Russia is also very dependent on these revenues for their export earnings and their government budget. And it's just, it's an important element to remember in this discussion. And finally, I also think that the European Union does have the projects of common interest under the Connecting Europe facility, where projects don't make 100% commercial sense and need a little help for energy security reasons, you know, under the PCI countries, member states can apply for and get these funds. And what we would like to see happen is that some of those, you know, there are a lot of competing projects. There's only so much money to go around, but it would be good to see those projects be prioritized and be funded in the next, you know, sooner rather than later.
Great. Let me first take the young lady there closer to the windows, and then I'll come and get you on the island next.
Thank you. Leandra Bernstein, RIA Novosti. I'd like to follow up on the question that was just asked, because in the United States, we often talk about energy security in Europe, which generally means, as you said, curbing the influence of Russia. But the conclusion of your report, as the panel said, is that Russian energy will still play a very important role in the European mix for the foreseeable future. So when you look at the American Western strategy, the security concerns, trying to curb Russia's influence by going after this energy component, how do you make sense of that? You mentioned the rhetoric versus the economics, but how can you make sense of this future of the importance of Russian energy, but then the rhetoric of the so-called security?
Sense of rhetoric, yeah. I think that my short answer would be that in a market environment that we have that there is in Europe today, economics dictate certain realities, in my view. Now, of course, one can change that. I mean, if you wanted to, I mean, a market reality that as is today does not necessarily need to be the market reality of tomorrow. And unexpected events, shocking events, could trigger such policy interventions. And so we cannot account for those, but we have noted, and I would note again that, you know, absent such drastic policy interventions, we do not foresee significant change. And then in that constellation, you need to look beyond the rhetorics, I guess. But it's part of the debate. I would also caution to dismiss, and this I don't think we wanted to do at all with our study or with our findings, to dismiss political realities. And it may very well be that there's a mismatch between what one would see a market do or expect a market do and what political realities are. Of course, those can be not aligned. It is possible that policymakers decide to intervene and design measures to change those realities. But we, at this point, do not foresee that happening. Not sure if that is a satisfactory answer to your question, but that's what I would say.
Let me take, do you still have a question? Good.
Hi, thanks. Jenny Mandel with Energy Wire. And a sort of related question directed towards Robin. What I'm hearing is that there is potential in the coming months to have significant shortages in Ukraine specifically, and I guess Bulgaria as well. And it seems like over the past many months, we've seen that when there's a flare-up of activity in Ukraine, then there's a corresponding flare-up of political interest in Congress. And, you know, measures are debated, which it sounds like you may be saying aren't really necessary, these sort of, you know, bigger structural changes, but, you know, natural gas exports from the U.S. and how those should be tailored to the European situation. So given that we can expect, you know, if there were a cold winter or even an average winter, potential shortages that would get big headlines in the U.S., how are you responding to that, and what does it mean for U.S. policy developments that may or may not be appropriate in the longer run that's being forecast here?
I do think U.S. LNG exports matter in the way I spoke about before and the impact on global markets, but that our first LNG exports aren't coming online until 2015. And then most of the licenses that have been approved start coming online in 2017, 2019. So U.S. LNG exports isn't going to be a solution or part of a solution for any problem this winter. Regarding the debate in Congress on our LNG export policy, you know, our export licenses, LNG export licenses, are governed by the Department of Energy. And you can actually go on Department of Energy's website and see who's in the queue and where they are and who they're going to sell to. And you see that those companies, commercial entities that have been granted licenses, have contracted for their gas, and they're making commercial decisions about where the gas is going. I don't envision a scenario in which the U.S. government comes in and tells companies that have contracted for gas already to send it somewhere else. That doesn't mean I don't think U.S. LNG exports in the immediate term don't impact the situation, because as I mentioned before, I do think they do because of the impact on global markets. But we are working hard to help ensure, as is the EU and as is Ukraine, I think, to help ensure that there isn't a crisis this winter. And we're doing as I mentioned before, it's sort of a multi-pronged approach that I think a lot of governments are doing. A combination of DOE just had a team out in Ukraine for several weeks looking at contingency measures. If there are gas shortages, USAID, as I mentioned, is doing work with energy efficiency measures. A lot of other governments are doing work. We're doing a lot of work with long-term planning on, like I said, domestic production. And the EU is working very hard, and we're supporting that effort to try to get the parties to reach an agreement.
Well, let me follow up on this. Suppose there were a really cold winter and a real crisis in Ukraine. Did I understand you and Tatiana right, Tim, that the only source of gas is Russia to make up the difference between what you outlined? Or in a real emergency, would it be possible to get more gas from somewhere, from Europe? And Robin, you said we have people, U.S. government has people in Ukraine talking about contingency measures. What would they be? What are we telling them in a really bad crisis? I mean, presumably that's the kind of contingency somebody's planning for, even if my point about doing a scenario of it is different. But suppose it were a really, really cold winter and people were starving and or freezing and starving too, probably. But, you know, people will die. What could be done?
Yeah, I'm afraid in this situation, Russian gas is the only solution. But you have to understand that it doesn't start in November or December. Yeah, so far Ukraine has already quite a good amount of gas in the underground storages, and it will definitely cover demand for the few first months of the winter. So we are talking about potential problems probably in the end of February, beginning of March. So it's not like the whole winter. But I still hope that there is a solution with the Russian gas supplies, and I hope it will be fixed right now, not in February.
Yeah, limited options, I think so too. Assuming that there's no transit, natural gas transit to Europe as well, which would be substantial. I mean, the Contrary to the situation we've seen in 2006 and 9, there's currently the Russians have gone at reasonable length to make sure that they meet their contractual obligations in Europe. But assuming that would not happen, and they would say, okay, look, we got to stop this because at some point I would assume the Ukrainians would decide to use some of that transit gas for their own, as has happened in the past. You know, assuming the Russians would say we're going to stop all of this, as we described earlier, the opportunities to ship different gas into Ukraine are limited. I mean, they're almost entirely used at this point. The ability of Europe to get natural gas into that part of the world is also limited, as we've touched upon earlier. That's exactly the part where more integration is needed. So I think for the larger part of Europe, you could attract alternative supplies, but then that part in Central and Eastern Europe that is still vulnerable would suffer as well. So that period of shortage, I guess, would not just apply to Ukraine, but also to countries like Hungary, Bulgaria, maybe Greece, you know, that part of the country.
I have time for one more question. Wayne, is that you back there? Back to back, Wayne Mary.
Hi, Wayne Mary, the American Foreign Policy Council. Gazprom is one of a number of very large Russian parastatal entities that have quite significant debt service loads that they are going to have to pay money on in the next 15 months. Rosneft is another, and it, of course, also exports energy to Europe. To what extent are these entities as much dependent on maintaining their revenue streams from the European sales as the consumers are in need of the energy? My question is basically, is Gazprom also to some degree now, at least in the next year, year and a half, a prisoner of debt service, that it has to be a reliable supplier because it needs the money to pay off that very considerable load of debt that's coming due between now and the end of 2015?
Thank you. Tatiana, you can take that.
It is, you are right, and the European exports are providing two-thirds of Gazprom revenues, while all sales to Russia and to CIS are providing just one-third. So you can understand how substantial it is for Gazprom's functioning, not saying about the new investment project. It has to build Power of Siberia. They started construction 1st of September, so they definitely need financing for that. So here I think it's this mutual dependence, like tortoise and snake case about friendship. It's the same story. And moreover, it's not just Gazprom. It's the whole state, which is strongly dependent on the budget revenues, 30% export duty for pipeline gas. It gives approximately 10% of total Russian budget revenues. And you can imagine in the country which is facing sanctions, which is facing at the same time quite weak economic performance, 10% of budget revenues, it's a big deal. So nobody is going to risk this, I think.
All right, well, I guess that's good news. So let's stop there before we come up with another bad scenario. Please join me in thanking our panelists.